Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the release of the new film Crazy Rich Asians and how it could shape Hollywood's diversity efforts in the future. It's an evil. First, music legend Aretha Franklin died today at her home in Detroit at the age of 76. Franklin is widely regarded as the Queen of Soul and was the voice behind some of the most well-known songs in the 20th century, including Respect, Chain of Fools, and Say a Little Prayer. Among her many accolades, she was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, and she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Central Time producer Dean Kennetter talked about Franklin's musical legacy with him earlier today.
Aretha was surrounded by music from a very early age. Her father was a famous Baptist minister, and there were a lot of musical luminaries stopping by their home in Detroit. How did those early years impact her style?
Well, those early years were fundamental. In a sense, Aretha Franklin was really a daughter of the Great Migration itself. Being in Detroit, one of the prime locations for many African Americans who moved from the South to the North during this period, and her father, C.L. Franklin, became a nationally and internationally known Baptist preacher. He was incredible as a performer, in a sense, in his own right. And as his fame and popularity grew, he came to know many of the great musicians of the time, whether it was Mahalia Jackson or Clara Ward, countless musicians who would often not just stop by the church, but often visit his home. They would often stay with him at times. And so from a very early age, Aretha was around some of the great singers of all time. But it's also worth noting that the tables were turned, because those luminaries would show up at their home and they would hear a young Aretha sing.
And
they would be overwhelmed by what they would hear, that they knew from the very start that she had a gift and that there was something special there that was going to really be transcendent, and that turned out to be the case.
But as good as she was, success was not immediate. It kind of took her finding the right production team and the right studio band, and that seemed to happen down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. What did she find there?
Well, what she found there was the gospel sound that she had grown up with, and I'll back up for a moment and explain what I mean by that. She had grown up around the gospel church and had started out being a gospel singer. It was clear that she had an extraordinary talent, and John Hammond, one of the great talent scouts of all time, he signed Aretha to Columbia Records, and there are some really fine songs on those Columbia albums that she cut, but there was an attempt to create a record that would sound like it was part of the pop canon, almost part of the pre-rock and soul canon, recording show tunes and Tin Pan Alley records. And that is something I should note that Aretha wanted to do, because she wanted to have a far-reaching kind of sound. She wanted to embody all that was good about American music. But it didn't capture the gospel and blues roots of her singing style. And that happens at Atlantic with Muscle Shoals, Alabama. What happens is that she signs to Atlantic after Columbia finally gives up on her, which still sounds astonishing today, but it was multiple albums later when they just couldn't figure out how to break her as a star. So Atlantic signed her, Jerry Wexler in particular, and decided that what she needed to do was go and play with Southern soul musicians and use that space to write songs and to interpret songs and to play piano in a way that would really draw out what was her strength in the first place, which was this gospel soul singing style.
It sounds like part of the key was letting her use her own talent. Like you said, playing piano, taking people to church, and kind of running the studio.
That's right. And that is significant for a number of reasons. Obviously, it was incredibly significant for Aretha's career, because by the time you get to 1967 or 1968, she has become a star as a result of having the freedom to produce the music the way that she wanted to produce it. It's also representative of how she was a trailblazer and changing the way that music itself was being recorded. This was particularly true for female artists, because they found themselves often before Aretha having to listen to the largely white producers, songwriters, and studio record executives who ran the music industry. And so although they would find ways to negotiate all of that and have their own voice heard, Aretha got the opportunity to really take control of her career and to take control of her voice, and not just her singing voice, but what she wanted to say. And what she wanted to say in 1967 and 1968 was about freedom, It was about respect, of course. It was about change.
And today she's being remembered definitely for that cultural impact, but also an artistic one as well. Undoubtedly one of the greatest singers of all time. And when you listen to those early Atlantic records we were talking about, you can hear her routinely overpowering the mics and the recording equipment. It's almost as if they weren't quite ready for what she was bringing to the table. When you listen to those songs, how do you hear her raising the bar for singers?
It's a bar that in many ways has yet to be surpassed.
I'm sure
that there are good arguments. I know there are good arguments for other singers who have come since and in their own way have raised the bar, right? But when you hear people talk about what Aretha was like in the studio, they're all just astonished at the power, the consistency of her voice, you know, the perfect pitch. It seemingly was effortless. Now, we know that that's not true. We know that she worked hard at maintaining her voice and growing her voice. Like any other artist, she worked hard to get to where she was. But she was given an extraordinary gift, a gift to be able to sing in such a wide range, to sing those high notes and to be able to scream when that scream was required, and yet at the same time to dig deep and to hear almost bass notes in her voice when she needed those too. It is, you know, it is an incredible legacy, and all of the great singers that followed her in the 1970s, whether it was someone who was sort of following along in terms of phrasing, like maybe Patti LaBelle or you know, certainly Gladys Knight and Dusty Springfield, for example, they were all trying in one way or another to figure out what to do with this incredible singer who was out there, who had indeed raised the bar for every other singer who was out there, and not just every female singer, every other singer who was out there. There's a reason why Rolling Stone put her number one on their list of the greatest singers of all time, right? That's not an accident. It's because everyone sees her as the model for what can be achieved by a human voice.
Well, Alexander, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Alexander Shashko of the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Dean Kinetter was also able to talk about Franklin's cultural impact with UW-Madison Afro-American Studies Professor Tulani Davis.
Well, a big part of Aretha's legacy is her identity. There had been mainstream African-American female singers before, but for someone to be on the radio singing with that level of assuredness and fire, did that do something socially beyond music?
I think it was at an intensity level that a lot of other things in the culture were at the time. There were, one or two years later, there was Richard Pryor, who was just knocking down walls of propriety, for instance. Mm-hmm. There was the intensity of political speech at the time, which was very freewheeling, and feminist speech. People were burning bras in Atlantic City. There was Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic Convention in 68, a sharecropper who was an organizer, saying to America things they had never heard, and certainly never from a black woman who picked cotton in the South. So Aretha fit right in the landscape, but she was offering us a kind of consolation, a kind of inspiration, courage, and also her voice was very percussive in a way that mm-hmm. other singers weren't, and it also soared to places that other singers did not. So it was an intense, inspiring experience to hear her.
And how do you think her gospel roots, her history there, informed her place in the civil rights movement?
Partly, I would say also it's the instrumental part of gospel music. She played, when she played the piano, it was straight out of gospel, and there was a driving intensity to it, also a percussive aspect to it mm-hmm. that we don't, or we didn't associate with sacred music in mainstream America. So there was, she could drive a song and drive the whole room with the gospel intonations and with the rhythms that she put on the piano.
And Aretha didn't often explicitly sing about politics or the civil rights movement on the surface, but she became a very a known figure in that regard. How did she maintain that identity or create it without singing explicitly about the news of the day?
Well, I think she actually did so by accepting the mantles we put on her. When those songs became anthems for movements, she accepted that. Mm-hmm. She expressed her politics in part by where she showed up to do it. And she would allow people to use her both to raise money for the movement and also to make... more present, make a larger impression of an event that was about the movement. And then, of course, showing up and singing at King's funeral, places like that. She took the mantle that I think really was given to her by her listeners and fans.
Well, Tulani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was UW-Madison Professor Tulani Davis speaking with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter. They looked back at the legacy of the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. One of the most highly anticipated movies of the summer opened this week. Crazy Rich Asians tells the story of a young woman who accepts her boyfriend's invitation to attend a wedding in his home country of Singapore, only to discover the family's immense wealth.
We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family? My Ama? I meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Take Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there.
While the film is noteworthy for not being another sequel or superhero film, it also stands out for another big reason. It's the first Hollywood movie with an entirely Asian-American cast since the 1993 film adaptation of Amy Tan's novel, The Joy Luck Club. Many are calling it a win for on-screen representation, but some questions remain over Hollywood's commitment to making movies with racially diverse actors, especially Asian-American casts. Lori Quito Lopez is an associate professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. Lori, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
For Asian-Americans, just how big of a deal is the release of this movie?
Oh, it's a huge deal. Yeah, Asian Americans have been waiting for something like this for a really long time. It's really rare for them to have the opportunity to be behind the camera, in front of the camera, the stars of the film, to have so much support for it. There's so many different factors that make this movie really singular.
As we mentioned in the introduction, this is the first film since 1993's The Joy Luck Club to have an entirely Asian American cast. Why do you think it's taken this long? That's 25 years.
Yeah, it has been a really long time, which has been really disappointing for Asian Americans. I just think that in Hollywood, they operate from a lot of assumptions, and they're always really focused on making lots of money, and so making assumptions about what audiences are going to pay money to see. And I think that there's been a lot of suspicion that Asian Americans wouldn't come out and support a film that was starring them, or that mainstream audiences and white audiences wouldn't be as interested in Asian American stories. And I also think that those kinds of logics really compound themselves to make it so that we don't have as many Asian American stars and celebrities who can really helm a film like this and then also guarantee those box office returns. So it's a lot of problems that involve racist assumptions and understandings about the way that American audiences work that then lead to fears about this kind of film.
And we're talking about an all Asian American cast, but historically, how would you rate Hollywood's track record with Asian American representation, maybe not in, you know, an Asian dominated movie, but just as part of the cast?
Yeah, it's been horrible. Hollywood films have a very bad track record with Asian Americans, where they've been stereotyped and portrayed in really negative ways or misrepresented, but also just that they haven't been included. So this is how we end up with whitewashed roles where maybe you would assume that the role should go to an Asian American, but it doesn't. It goes to a white actor who historically it was more common that we saw them in yellowface where they would pretend to be Asian. And now it's just kind of like, oh, that Asian character never existed. Let's just have a really famous white actor or actress take on that role altogether. So those are some of the huge problems that have faced Asian Americans in Hollywood.
Do you think that's been particularly bad for Asian Americans as compared to, say, Latinos or African Americans?
All minority groups face similar problems. I think that Asian Americans happen to be the smallest minority of those three. So we do see Hollywood responding a little bit better to African Americans or Latinx representations because there is presumed to be more interest in those groups, or that they have more buying power, or that they could make a bigger stink about it. So Asian Americans are such a small minority. And then sometimes there's this assumption that Asian Americans also will break down into their different ethnic groups, and that maybe like Chinese Americans would be mad about one thing or Indian Americans would be mad about something else. So those are some of the differences between the groups, but in general, it's pretty bad for minorities of all kinds in Hollywood.
It is interesting because Asian American encompasses a huge diversity of different groups, but it is also, I believe, the fastest or one of the fastest growing ethnic groups in the U.S. So maybe that will change some of the Hollywood thinking.
Yeah, I hope so, because Asian Americans came together under the understanding that if they joined together as a political group, they would have more power and be able to fight together to fight racism more effectively. So given that that's the whole reason behind the Asian American collective identity, I do hope that the growing size of it starts to be more meaningful in all arenas, you know, beyond Hollywood, also in politics and, you know, education and all sorts of things. But one of the cool things about this movie is actually that it does represent so many different kinds of Asian Americans, that it's really multi-ethnic, and it's portraying this very cosmopolitan form of Asian identity where it's not even just Asian American. You know, it's about the Asian diaspora and all of these different Asian groups that can come together in a family or through friendship and all these different relationships that they have. So although it doesn't represent all Asian Americans or all Asians, and I think some people are conspicuously missing and won't see themselves represented in this film, it is one of the cool things about the film that it represents a lot of different kinds of Asians.
We're talking with Lori Quito Lopez right now. She's Associate Professor of Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the release yesterday of the film Crazy Rich Asians, which has an all Asian American cast. And Lori, you know, I was thinking about the fact that it's been 25 years since the Joy Luck Club came out, that movie adaptation of Amy Tan's novel. And that was about the experience of Asians coming to America and becoming Asian American. This is kind of in some ways the opposite. This is Asian Americans going back to where their families came from.
Yeah, and I actually think that there's some interesting parallels between those differences and the way that Asian American identities and experiences in the U.S. have evolved, where in the early days of the Asian American movement, Asian Americans were really focused on saying we're different from Asians in Asia, that we're Asian American and we speak English as our primary language and we don't have all these cultural connections to people who are living in Asia. But I think that the truth is that Asian Americans do have connections to Asia, and that we have a lot of people who see themselves as living in the diaspora and having different ideas of their homeland. We have a lot of recent immigrants who are part of Asian America. And I think that while Asians from Asia have always been part of the political identity of Asian America, it also makes sense to kind of tell this story about Asian Americans' very complicated relations to Asia, and the idea that we shouldn't just say, you know, only people who are born in the U.S. count or should have a political voice. And so the idea that family and culture and language and global politics connect Asians in Asia and the U.S. is really important, particularly right now.
It seems that, like you said, there's a lot riding on this because it has been so long. There has not been predominantly or entirely Asian American cast in a movie for 25 years. And so there's a lot of pressure on this to succeed. Have there been efforts in the industry from Asian Americans in the film industry to give it a boost, to really try to help make it profitable?
Yeah, I've been really excited to see that, actually, because sometimes you see a really great film come out and the studio doesn't support it enough, and that can cause its failure, even if it's a really great film and even if you think some audiences would connect with it. But I've seen the opposite. So Warner Brothers has done a really spectacular job marketing the film and trying to do their very best to make sure it can be as successful as it can be. So I've seen huge advertising campaigns. I think my friends in Los Angeles say they see billboards all over town, which always makes us very excited. They've been hosting screenings with Asian American community groups and community leaders. There's been Asian American activism to buy out theaters and, you know, grassroots activism to have like Twitter campaigns. And it's really been going from every level, from just like everyday theater goers who will say, I'll buy tickets for all my friends to make sure this film does well on opening weekend, to people who are really Hollywood movers and shakers who are saying, this is our chance. If this is successful, we're going to get all these new films for Asian Americans greenlit. So we need to help sort of from the top down. We need to create new policies that make sure that we include Asian Americans in every step. So I think this is a really great opportunity to bring together all different kinds of forms of activism, ranging from like traditional grassroots activism to the kind that happens inside of big businesses and corporations.
And as we start to wrap up, you've said that representation is so important. This is a fictional movie. Is it just as important to see Asian Americans portrayed well in something like that than in some of the more serious areas, like you were saying, like politics, education, things like that? What does it mean to see yourselves on the screen?
Yeah, absolutely. It's important in every way. So it's important to have Asian Americans represented in really serious roles where, like, you know, our histories are documented, or to hear the voices of our great thinkers. But it's also really important to just have fun and be able to see Asian Americans, you know, making mistakes and being ridiculous and, you know, having all of their different sides explored. I think that those are the kinds of things that really resonate with Asian American audiences. And I've seen a big reaction from Asian American audiences where people are crying a lot at the film. And I myself was crying through much of the film. And I think that it does just feel so powerful to see those representations that we haven't seen either ever before or in a really long time. And so even though the film is very lighthearted, very funny, very silly, it's truly a romantic comedy. It's not trying to do anything serious at all. I do think it has a really serious emotional impact for Asian American viewers.
Well, Lori, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Lori Quito Lopez is an associate professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. She's also the author of Asian American Media Activism, Fighting for Cultural Citizenship. She joined us to talk about the release of the film Crazy Rich Asians and the significance of its all-Asian American cast. Think back to the last time something broke in your home. What did you do? Well, there's a good chance you threw the item away, only to drive to the store or buy a new one online. It may have been cheap and convenient to get a new item, but could it have been fixed instead? Our next guest is part of a growing movement that aims to change the way we think about stuff, namely that repair should be an essential part of a sustainable economy. That means fixing our broken items, big or small, in an effort to make a dent in our throwaway culture. Sandra Goldmark is a designer, teacher, and entrepreneur. She's the founder of FixUp, which she describes as an innovative social enterprise aimed at building a healthy model of household consumption. Sandra, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Judith. Thank you for having me.
In general, why do you think we as a culture have gotten away from repairing things?
Well, I think it's been a long, slow process. Most people think about the post-war years, the post-World War II years, as the explosion of mass-produced goods and a big decline in a more old-fashioned way of taking care of stuff, although I think it really dates to earlier. It's basically part of industrialization, as it has gotten easier and easier for us to mass-produce cheap, and cheaper stuff. Repair has fallen to the wayside to some extent in our economy.
How much have we seen a decline in people who are out there available to repair things? It doesn't seem like you see shops that mm-hmm. are places where you could take that blender or that telephone.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been working on this topic for many years, and I haven't found really great, accurate statistics on the official decline of repair, but I think every single person I've talked to has seen it anecdotally. When I grew up, I live in New York, and I grew up in Brooklyn, and when I was little, I used to go down to 7th Avenue with my mother. We would run errands, and she would take something to the jeweler and take something to the, like, TV guy, and those shops just don't exist anymore, and I think that's the case across the country.
So what got you thinking about this and wanting to do something about it?
Well, about 5 years ago, I was home on maternity leave, which I know is a great time to start a new project.
You know, not much else to do.
Yeah. It actually worked because I just, you know, he just came everywhere with me. But I just was getting irritated because I felt like all this stuff was breaking in the house. I did have a newborn, so I did not have time to deal with it. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I remember the real sort of straw that broke the camel's back was the vacuum, because I knew it could be fixed. It wasn't that big of a problem. I called the vacuum cleaner company and I said, my vacuum's broken. What can I do? And they said, well, the nearest service center is in Hackensack. So for you guys, that doesn't mean much, but for a woman with a newborn in New York, I was not going to drive like an hour and a half to Hackensack for a vacuum. And I thought, this is crazy. There has to be an easier way. It should be easy to get this fixed. And that was the start. I thought, well, let's try it. Well, there's a little more backstory here. So my husband and I work in theater. I'm a designer and he's a production manager and technical director. So I knew that it could be fixed. Like in theater, if you have a broken chair or a broken vacuum and that chair or vacuum needs to go on stage, well, you know, you find a way to fix it and you get it out on stage. So I thought, if we can do it at work, why can't we do it at home? Why can't I get my vacuum fixed and make it work again?
So you founded something called Pop-Up Repair, now called Fix-Up.
That's right.
What is the structure of this organization?
So we started by opening, we thought it was just going to be one. We started by opening one little repair shop in our neighborhood. It was going to be a 1 month thing because, you know, my maternity leave was ending and we thought, well, this will be fun. And the idea was, first of all, to fix a whole bunch of stuff, because it seemed to me that the idea, you know, like when I was little, of going to three different errands, well, that doesn't work anymore. When in households where both parents are working, nobody has time to run five errands for five broken things. So we said, let's just open a shop. We'll hire a whole bunch of our friends from theater to fix all these different things. And let's see if anybody shows up.
And they did.
They showed up and they thought, it was hysterical. They showed up with like bags of stuff, you know. Well, first they would come with just one thing, you know, the vacuum, the lamp, whatever it is. And they'd look around and see all the other stuff that other people had brought. And they were like, oh, you can fix necklaces and plates and toys and chairs. And so they would go home and get all their other stuff and bring it back. And it turns out people were holding on to these things in like closets and corners of their apartment. I don't know why. And, you know, hoping for the day when some random theater person would open a store. It was a very interesting thing that we uncovered.
Well, one of the articles I read in preparing for this conversation talked about that even when people replace something because it's broken, they often keep it. And maybe it's a sense of guilt. Maybe it's a hope, you know, someday this will work again and I can give it to my kid when they're going off to college or moving into their first apartment. I think that indicates that there is a desire to not just toss things away, to actually, you know, use things for as long as their lifespan can last. And so it sounds like, you know, it was kind of a, if you build it, they'll come. You started this and people came.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. And I think to me, that's the most hopeful sign in this whole thing, you know, in our sort of wasteful society. Some people think, forget it. People will always go for the cheap new thing and will never fix things anymore. And I think that one of the most important things in our work that we've discovered is this really strong urge that people have. It's almost like a loyalty to the things that they already own. And what I think is happening is that our society, we have two urges as people, as like, you know, primates. We see a new shiny thing and we want that because, ooh, it's yummy and new and shiny and I can get it on Amazon. But we also, it turns out, have this emotional attachment to the things that we already have, like a weird old black plastic fan that there's no reason I should hold on to it, but I did. My old clunky vacuum. There was nothing special about it, right?
Exactly.
But our society right now is only supporting the first urge, right? Because selling new things is the only way our economy is fueled right now. But we have this second urge as human beings. And I think if we can find a way to structure our economy to support that and see that as a valuable source of growth, there's hope there to reduce our waste and consumption.
We're talking with Sandra Goldmark right now. She's the founder of Fix Up, and we're talking about a global movement to start repairing things and fixing things and extending their lives instead of throwing them out and replacing them. And Ezra on Facebook says, my wife does it all the time, especially at work. The maintenance people know she will jerry-rig it together so it works properly, allowing them plenty of time to get to it without sacrificing other projects. And I have to say, you know, I think that would be the ideal coworker, someone who can say, oh yeah, I can fix that.
Mm-hmm. And those people are everywhere, actually, is the other great thing. People love doing things with their hands. It's very satisfying to make something work again, you know, make it behave the way you want it to behave. It's very fundamental to who we are. So I think it's fun in this project to watch people kind of come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, I do that. I love fixing things.
So there are people like Ezra's wife and also like your theater friends who can come together and say, hey, you know, I can fix that for you. But there's also the other part of this movement, which is I can fix this and you can watch. And that way, the next time it breaks or something similar breaks, you're going to be able to fix it yourself. Tell us about that side of Fix Up.
So there's both within Fix Up and, as you say, in the larger repair movement, there's two sides. One is repair cafes are the strongest example of an educational model where people come together, repair cafes are volunteer, and you sit with somebody and you learn to fix something and gain some skills. So we at Fix Up do a lot of educational events like that. But then there's another side, I think, that needs to grow, which is basically drop-off service. It's sometimes you don't have time, you've got a newborn, you don't have the skills, whatever. You need somebody else to fix it. And I think the two go hand in hand. I think it's like food. Sometimes you want to go out to dinner and have somebody else cook you a nice meal. And sometimes you want to cook at home and do things on your own. And actually, an appreciation of both, they're sort of synergistic, a kind of appreciation for how you consume and the care you take with your food or your stuff.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Jackie in Crystal Lake, Illinois is with us. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, nice to talk to you. It's funny because I just walked in the door and I just come back from You Break It, I Fix It, which they fix computers and electronics and stuff. But I brought my Panasonic landline phone. My granddaughter was like 18 months last summer and she just grabbed it and like with her thumb, I was just in awe at how fast she was. And I was like, oh my God, you know. But so it didn't work. And I, you know, tried to reset. I couldn't reset it. And it stopped charging. The batteries were new and they're expensive. And then it had another pair. But anyways, she fixed it. She didn't charge me. Oh. I was like, how did you just reset it? And it's amazing. Every time I go in the store, it's super busy. But, you know, they probably don't do, like, vacuums and that kind of stuff. Because I feel contrarian to the fact that we're a new society. Because I think nobody wants to read those 200-page manuals, you know, if they can avoid it and they like the old. And sometimes you get a gift and it has sentimental value. And, you know, I mean, I'd rather keep the old stuff. Yeah,
great. Thanks for that, Jackie. We're losing the connection a little bit. But that's an interesting angle to this because we have become more and more high tech. And I think, you know, there's a big difference between maybe tinkering around with a lamp and trying to fix the wiring and trying to fix a smartphone or a computer.
There is, though. Interestingly enough, in some ways, they're very different in terms of who might tackle it or who might feel confident tackling it. But ultimately, I think there's something in common with them, which is if you design something to be fixed, it makes it much easier to do it. Like most lamps are designed to be rewired fairly easily because everybody knows they're going to need to be rewired once in a while. Phones could actually be, even smartphones can be designed better to become easier to fix, either to fix yourself or to make it easier for, you know, local service providers to do it. So while some of the higher tech stuff can be scarier or seem harder to be done, it is possible, I think, if we approach it as well from the design end as well.
We're talking right now with Sarah Goldmark. She's founder of Fix Up, and we're talking about a growing movement across the globe to get people fixing things again, as opposed to throwing them in the trash. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. When a household item breaks down, do you just throw it away or do you try and fix it up? How are your own personal repair skills? Would you take the opportunity to make them better? Have you gone to a repair cafe or maybe helped out at one? And what questions do you have for Sandra about fixing things? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Sandra Goldmark. She's a designer, teacher, and entrepreneur, and we're talking about the value of repair, namely that we can and should be fixing things instead of just tossing them in the trash. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fixer? Who taught you? What have you repaired around the house that would have gone in the trash otherwise? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Diane on Facebook shared, she said, we fix phones, chairs, tables, lamps, faucets, doors, screens, inside a toilet. So many things, it's hard to remember all of them. It's very hard for us to let someone else fix things for us, and new is not always better. And, you know, I think there is something to that. If you buy quality items, Sandra, you know, there maybe it will be easier to replace them, but you might not be getting the same quality either.
Yeah, I think ideally my sort of vision of the way, because we do need new stuff in the world. We can't always fix everything. But if we made things a little better to begin with, or a lot better, they might be a little more expensive, but they would last longer. And it is a little bit of an old-fashioned way of thinking about stuff, but I think it's actually something that we need to adapt for the future as well.
How are companies and manufacturers of products feeling and responding to this growing repair movement? I mean, there is something to be said for them wanting to sell us more stuff, and more stuff is often stuff to replace old stuff. But I noticed on your website, for instance, that you have some corporate partners. So clearly there are some businesses that see a value in this.
I think a lot of manufacturers and retailers out there are thinking about this very seriously, and that's really exciting. They know that we have an ecological crisis. They know that we cannot continue to extract materials and manufacture at the rate we're going, that it is simply not sustainable environmentally or for them from a business point of view. So I think around the world, people are starting to think about this and think it's very simple. It's an economic question, is can we... You know, repair used to be something people made their living off of, people could make money off of. And today it's very hard to do that, or today in the West. But if we can create a model where it is possible, again, to see repair as something valuable and something that can make money, the sky's the limit. I mean, imagine if you could walk into a big box retailer and maybe buy a new lamp or get your old lamp fixed. Maybe that retailer could make money off the same lamp three times. Hmm. It would be amazing.
Let's go,
could change the game.
Let's go to the phones, and Jeff in Pelican Lake is up first. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hi. I'm a retired dental technician. I used to have my dental lab. I make crowns and bridges, things like that. But now that I'm retired, I learned how to repair chainsaws. And so we repair chainsaws that were made in the 50s. And the best story I can tell you is we had a dairy farmer come in, and he had a chainsaw, and he had next to nothing as far as money, but he needed a chainsaw, and he couldn't afford to buy a new one because they run anywhere from $200 to $400 for a new chainsaw. So we fixed his chainsaw for $20, and he started crying.
Oh, that's great.
Wow.
You know, but we can – normally any repair we do on a chainsaw in parts usually is like $50. And parts are available. We can go online. We can go to eBay, because a lot of these guys take old stuff apart and then resell the good stuff online.
Mm-hmm.
And so parts are available all the time, and we have no problem. You know, and I understand, you know, about people throwing stuff away. You know, you can buy a chainsaw for under $100 now, but it's all plastic.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for that story, Jeff. And I think that's really interesting that it's kind of the old and the new coming together. So repairing these 50, 60-year-old chainsaws, partly thanks to the internet being able to find those parts.
It is. It's absolutely amazing. And that is, I think it's really exciting to think, how can we use the new technology that we have now to make these old practices viable and easy? It has to be easy for people. That's one of the key barriers today, I think, for a lot of people to get things fixed, is it just takes more work. So that's one of my main goals, is to find ways to make it easy for people to fix instead of buy new.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mac in Manitowoc is up. Hey, Mac.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a engine rebuilder. I work in a engine machine shop in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and we fix people's, you know, engines and a lot of other stuff for like industrial companies all the time. And from what I'm only 27, but from what I hear from some of the older employees I work with, is there used to be a lot of shops around that did this type of stuff, and now there's very few. And it's sad, because we do great work, and doing this actually made me want to go back to school, and I'm going back to school right now to be an engineer, and that's what I hope to do, is, you know, make things that can be repaired, because we live in a throwaway world, and it's too bad.
Thanks for that call, Meg, and that is an interesting question, Sandra. I mean, there aren't a lot of places out there to get things fixed. So we don't fix things, we replace them, but that also doesn't create a demand for the people that fix things. So right. Kind of what would you see in your experience as the key to interrupting that cycle?
Well, I guess that's exactly it. That's what we've been working on, is the idea of just starting small. And that's why we partner with other organizations, is because we feel like different organizations need to come together to plant these little seeds, so that, as you say, if you build it, they will come. Like when we opened our first shop, there was no demand. We opened the doors of the shop and all of a sudden there was a demand. So we've worked with cities, we've worked with nonprofits, we've worked with corporations. And I think that is the way, is for a kind of interdisciplinary, cross-cultural way to say, hey, we can do this if we work on it together.
I want to take one more quick call. Keith in Green Bay is up. Hi, Keith.
Hi. When I was a teenager, I went to the old Boys Tech High School in Milwaukee. And freshmen there took what was called exploratory shop. Mm-hmm. You got a couple of weeks in each of the different shop areas to find out where your talents were and where your interests were. But it taught me a lot of life skills. I know enough to fix a toilet, to rewire a lamp, to fix a piece of furniture, to do a little automotive repair. I know enough to know when I can do it and when I need to hire a professional.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Keith. And so, Sandra, that's an interesting idea. Get people started young with this idea.
Yeah, and it is a shame. I had a shop class in high school as well. I made a metal dustpan. But really, I learned most of my skills in the theater, which is a place where all this stuff still happens. But yeah, I think it's important to teach people to work with their hands, all children. As this caller, as Keith said, it's life skills, and it's a really important way of interacting with the world.
Well, as we start to wrap up, Sandra, briefly, what would you say to people who have never even really thought of trying to repair something themselves? What would you say to them to get them started?
Oh, it's fun. I would say just do it. It's broken already anyway, right? You can't make it worse. That's the one great thing about repair. And there's tons of videos. Anything you want to fix, there's a video for it on YouTube. And if people who are out there who are interested in taking the next step, we have been beginning to partner with people outside of New York to train them and help them open little pop-up shops like we've done. So we're happy to talk with people who want to learn how to do more.
And Sandra, thank you so much for joining us today. And what are you working on? What are you fixing right now?
Today, it's not a fixed job, but we are chopping down a whole bunch of wooden shutters and attaching them back together to make a sort of wall hanging for the dining room.
That sounds great. See, it can be pretty as well as functional.
Reuse and repair, yep.
Awesome.
Funny that you asked that today.
Well, Sandra Goldmark is a designer, teacher, and entrepreneur. She's also the founder of Fix Up, which looks to build a healthy model of household consumption. She joined us today to make the case for fixing things instead of just throwing them away. And we'd still love to hear from you over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you're a fixer, tell us what you fixed and give us the pitch for why we shouldn't throw things out. It is National Roller Coaster Day, and it turns out that we have some roller coaster fans here on staff at Wisconsin Public Radio. One of them is Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez. Rachel, tell us why you love them.
I think my favorite thing about roller coasters is probably my mom's least favorite thing. It's the click, click, click right at the beginning. That and I love going really fast and going upside down.
Upside down. I love the kind of corkscrewy kind of ones.
Yes, the loop-de-loop.
Yes, when you're hoping you're going to stay in there, and if not, you know, how far could it be? Keely Boltena is the executive producer of The Morning Show, also a fan.
It's interesting to watch people who are on it with me. I like seeing the picture afterwards. The experience itself, not great, but knowing that I managed to get through it is my favorite part.
So bragging rights.
Absolutely.
And The Morning Show is actually talking about roller coasters tomorrow.
We are. We're going to spend some time right at 6 a.m. To talk about a zippy tour of Wisconsin's 10 roller coasters with Lori Nickel. And one of those we should highlight is one of the world's oldest wooden roller coasters. It is in Green Bay. It was moved from Memphis. It's the Zippin' Pippin', and it was reportedly Elvis's favorite roller coaster.
Well, there you go. National Roller Coaster Day. If you love roller coasters, tweet us a picture of yourself on one. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.